North Untapped is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. Traffic congestion, fatal collisions, long commutes, pollution, a warming climate, the miseries of suburban life, carved up landscapes and displaced communities. What do all these things have in common? According to a new book titled Road to Nowhere, What Silicon Valley Gets Wrong About the Future of Transportation, the ubiquity of single passenger vehicles and the suburban sprawl that was built to accommodate them is the product of a very intentional plan in the 20th century to force the hegemony of the car onto the public. As the book's author, Paris Marx, writes, the corporations didn't predict a car-centric consumerist future, they made it a reality. Today, in a world of ride-sharing apps and the prospect of more widely available products like self-driving cars and electric vehicles, Road to Nowhere observes that big tech companies have expanded from the digital sphere into the physical world, with a particular focus on shaping transportation systems, and more specifically, a focus on maintaining the supremacy of the car. But, as the book explains, that future is one built on false promises that will not deliver an equitable version of automobility simply by upgrading it with new technologies. I'm Alex Kosh, Managing Editor of The Maple, and this week I'm very pleased to be joined by Paris, who is also the host of the excellent Tech Won't Save Us podcast, to discuss their new book and their case for how we can build better transportation systems and better cities. Paris, thank you very much for joining us, and many congratulations on this very important book.
Thanks so much, Alex. I'm so happy to join you on the show.
So I'm sure quite a significant chunk of our listeners will be regular listeners of your podcast and big fans of your work. But I've kind of always wanted to ask this. Could you describe to us, like, what does Tech Won't Save Us mean? And I don't just mean the podcast. I mean kind of the political mission and the frame of analysis that this represents.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think sometimes it can be misinterpreted as like a solely anti-technology stance, which is not really, you know, my aim. But, you know, if you were to add all the qualifications to it, it wouldn't be such a catchy title, right? So I settled for that. But I would say more than saying that, like, all technology is bad and we need to avoid technology, the goal of the show is really to say that, you know, are these technologies serving the public? And to, you know, try to have people to recognize that, especially after the past decade or so of the experience of technology that we've had from Silicon Valley and the narratives that have been put out there that, like, you know, as long as we adopt these new technologies, that the world is going to get better and things are going to improve, that we've seen that that's not so much the case. And it's not just, you know, developing new technologies and unleashing new technologies onto the world that make the world better. Rather, in order for those technologies to benefit the world, they need to be accompanied by a politics that actually, you know, is geared toward ensuring that that happens. And so that's kind of the goal of the show, is to say, like, you know, we can't be so focused on technology. We need to recognize the ways that technology is having a really negative impact on the world around us because these technologies emerge from capitalism, you know, are shaped by capitalism. And if we're actually going to have, you know, a better world and technologies that help facilitate a better world, that is going to require a different politics to realize.
Totally. It really seems like a departure from the kind of techno-utopianism that we hear from these thought leaders like, to the extent that he does think at all, Elon Musk and similar types of people. I'm wondering, how would you say that your frame of analysis differs from books like, for example, Fully Automated Luxury Communism by Aaron Bastani? Like, what are the similarities? What are the differences between these two tracts?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I would say that, you know, even though I might disagree with Bastani on Fully Automated Luxury Communism, like, I have a lot of respect for his work and what he's done, right? I haven't had this conversation with him, but I also get a feeling that maybe his views have changed a bit with some of the things he's been saying recently, particularly around climate and things like that. But, you know, I think that there's a way of seeing technology that I would tend to disagree with, that technology is simply a tool, right? And that depending on who wields the tool, that will determine how it gets used. So right now we have capitalists who are wielding this tool of technology. And so it's being used in ends that help them and that, you know, promote capital accumulation, profit, you know, exploitation of workers, all these sorts of things. And that if we just seize those technologies and reoriented to them toward a socialist purpose, then those same technologies would work for us in a socially beneficial way. And I would say I disagree with that. I would say that there are some technologies where that is certainly true, where it acts as a tool, you can wield it in one way or another, and for many different purposes. But I would say that there are also technologies, and this is pulling from the work of people like Langdon Winner and David Noble, who are, you know, well-known critics of technology and scholars of technology, who would say that, sure, there are some of those kind of tool-like technologies, but you can also see, especially as, you know, we've seen the development of these more complex technologies, that they are not so much a tool, and they are intimately shaped by, you know, capitalism and by capitalist social relations. And it's not so easy just to pick them up and wield them for a different cause. And so by adopting these technologies, we're actually building in these kind of capitalist relations into our society, into the way that things work. And so I have a serious concern about that. And I don't think that just relying on the development of technology, assuming that kind of happens in a linear way, that regardless of the social system, technology is always going to proceed in the same kind of direction, that is how we improve society. I don't have the same faith in technology in order to deliver these benefits that things like fully automated luxury communism promise.
And I suppose that one of the perfect examples that your book grapples with quite extensively is the car, which, as you explain, was, you know, intimately shaped by a capitalistic vision. Before we get into that, could you just tell us, like, what inspired you to write this book, and why did you focus on this topic specifically?
Yeah, I've been interested in, you know, transportation and technology for a long time, and certainly the relationship between the two. Since I would say before 2015, 2015 is when I really started to like write about these topics. And then, you know, that kind of slowly built its way into like a freelance career that I do now. And then in 2018, I started a master's degree in urban geography that was specifically focused on this question of what Silicon Valley has proposed for the future of transportation and whether that is actually going to, you know, deliver benefits to the public or is just kind of, you know, serving the ideas and the business goals of these particular companies. And so once I finished that in 2020, you know, I wasn't sure what I was going to do with it after that. And some people suggested a book, and I was like, you know, there's not really a book that looks at these ideas in more of like a broad scale. Like there's books that specifically look at Uber or specifically look at Tesla. And those are fantastic in many cases, like books like Super Pumped by Mike Isaac or Ludicrous by E.W. Niedermeyer. Those are fantastic books that dig into these companies. But there was not one that kind of pulled back, I guess, and looked more broadly at what these companies were trying to do in the transportation system. And so, you know, I spoke to some people and eventually I spoke to Leo Hollis at Verso Books, who's my editor there. And they were really interested. So we went ahead and did it. And now, you know, a year and a half or so later, it's out into the public and people can read it.
That's awesome. And just to reemphasize to listeners, it really is a fascinating read. So can you give us a kind of like brief overview? Like, how did the car rise to supremacy in North American life? I mean, it's obviously something that, you know, especially those of us living in more rural settings like I do, it's a fact of life. Like there isn't really any option for public transit. It to the extent that it does exist, it's terrible. It's infrequent and unreliable. So how did this happen? And also, like, was there anything in your historical research that you were particularly surprised by?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think, you know, going back to the history, because, you know, we're obviously in this moment where the car is normalized and has been normalized for generations. And the idea that, you know, for many people that we wouldn't rely on the automobile and would get around in some other kind of way is just kind of unimaginable, right? And so going back to the early days when the automobile was emerging, like the late 1800s, early 1900s, when they're starting to hit the streets, was really illustrative of what was actually happening in that moment and how it wasn't just that this new technology, the automobile, arrived on scene, and then because this was a symbol of progress, because this was new, we naturally needed to rearrange the way that the transportation system worked to accommodate this new mode of transportation. That was not the case, right? Before the automobile emerged, and even as there were not very many of them on the streets, You know, people use the streets in very different ways. People would walk on the streets, take their bikes on the streets, use streetcars, horse-drawn carriages, like all of these different modes of transportation were kind of working together. And on the side streets, you'd have kids like, you know, playing games and stuff because it wasn't so dangerous to be on the street. The streets were very much like a public space in a sense. But when the car arrived, that didn't really work so well because they went quicker than other modes of transportation. And as a result, because they were heavier, they started to hit people. They started to kill people. That affected children and young women in particular. And naturally, that provoked a response by people who lived in cities who didn't like to see this happening to themselves and to the people they cared about, right? And so there were demonstrations and protests against the car to try to stop their attempt at domination of the streets. And eventually, you know, the car makers and the automakers and the various industries that were associated with them and benefiting from the rollout of the automobile, you know, kind of came together, started working with the newspapers in particular to change how people thought about the streets and cars and transportation, you know, so that people started to feel that, you know, the street was a space for automobiles and not for people. And if you wanted to cross, you had to do so at specific, you know, crossing points. And if not, you were a jaywalker, which was a new term at the time that suggests that you just didn't understand how the city worked, right? But then they also, you know, worked with governments and did political lobbying to ensure that there were subsidies, that the government was embarking on infrastructure projects to build out the infrastructure of the automobile, and, you know, changing a whole load of regulations to encourage the adoption of the automobile. And so you can see that, it, as I was saying, it was not just like this technology arrives, it rolls out, is naturally adopted, but rather the adoption of that technology requires a lot of work by the government in order to entrench it and to make it happen, right? And I would say the piece I was most surprised about in going back to that period and learning about what happened with the rollout of the automobile was really just to see how, you know, how fraught it was, like how there was opposition to this. Because as I was saying, like, it's normalized right now, right? The car is around. Sure, there are people who recognize there are issues with the dominance of the car in society. But like, the story that we're told is just, you know, the car is freedom, the car is progress, it's modernity. Naturally, it was going to be adopted. But then you go back and look at these early days and see, like, that was not at all a given, right? Things could have gone a very different way, had a different set of interests kind of come out on top in this battle for the street. And it does suggest to us that, you know, or reminds us, hopefully, that transportation can work differently if we choose, you know, if we make different decisions about how the system should be planned and for who it should be planned for.
I found that so interesting how your book dealt with this, you know, question of it. You know, the car didn't just happen as a piece of technological innovation that, you know, moved along some kind of, you know, and I'm using scare quotes here, natural train of progress. But, you know, it required a lot of intervention and it required a lot of hard work and coordination between capitalist interests and, you know, various other interests in the state. To what extent do we also see this in kind of modern technological quote unquote innovations? Like, you know, we've seen these scandals about the Uber lobbying, for example. Where do we see similar issues happening where like these new technological products have to be kind of forced onto the public in that way?
Yeah, I would say what we see like in recent history is almost less so like the government changing regulations in order to entrench these technological products, but rather the government kind of pulling back and saying, you can kind of do what you want, right? We're going to deregulate this space, or we're going to choose not to regulate it so that you can choose what the regulatory framework is going to look like on your own. So like Uber, for example, you know, it worked with a lot of politicians largely to ensure it wasn't regulated out of existence or wasn't treated as a taxi company. And then in some cases, it did develop its own regulatory framework and had the politicians, you know, effectively pass that into law. And one of the first cities to do that was Toronto. And that was revealed in these recent Uber file revelations as well, the degree to which Mayor Tory had relationships with Uber executives and the Uber company. And you know, was close with them and basically just passed a regulatory framework that copied exactly what Uber was giving political figures. And so I think that's a lot of the problem recently, is this like faith in the market and faith in the tech companies that they know what's best for us, and that they are going to, you know, put these products out into the world that are going to improve society in the way that they promise, right? Because their marketing pitch would have us believe that everything they do is about, you know, making life better for people. But then when we actually look at the effects of that, you know, a few years down the line after they've launched the product, we can see that that's not exactly how it works, right? Uber didn't reduce traffic and make transportation more accessible and all these sorts of things. It actually did the opposite in many cases, right? It made traffic worse. It increased the emissions of trips. It mainly served people who are quite well off, who live in cities, are college educated, not the type of people who are lacking transportation. And so, you know, the government still has a role to play here, but the government's role has been less to regulate, to entrench these business models, because I would argue that these technologies are not very disruptive, quote unquote, as they like to tell us. You know, they're not really changing automobility, as you said in your introduction, but are rather taking a step back and saying, okay, you know, you can choose what is going to happen here. You can implement your technologies in whatever way you see fit. And we're not going to step in to ensure that that actually serves the public or produces the benefits that you say it does, because we have faith in you. Because, you know, after decades of neoliberalism, you know, the message has been trust the market, trust the companies. And that's not serving us very well.
It's really interesting how you note that, like, you know, tech in general really became celebrated as a kind of key economic driver in the wake of the 2008 financial crash. Can you tell us a bit more about that? Like, who were the key figures promoting this, and like, why were they so keen to boost the tech sector specifically?
Yeah, it's a good question. And like, it's certainly something that has been growing over time, right? Like, Ronald Reagan had relationships with the tech sector back in the 80s because it helped to promote this whole vision that he had, that we were going to have like this kind of entrepreneurial economy and the government wasn't going to be involved in things. And that's when we see a real kind of, or at least the beginning of this rebranding of the tech industry as something that's not so much out of, you know, Cold War defense spending, but it's entrepreneurial, market oriented, all these sorts of things, empowering the individual. And then in the 90s with Clinton, Bill Clinton, Al Gore, even Newt Gingrich on the Republican side are very much close to the tech industry, very much trying to promote these visions that the tech industry and the government both want to promote, these neoliberal visions that, you know, sure, we can gut welfare spending, we can increase the carceral state, but because we're going to expand access to the internet, it's going to be good for everyone and everyone will be able to find jobs online, right? And so you can see how it really works for these politicians and their kind of political, you know, political motivations, what they're trying to achieve. And so after the 2008 recession, you know, we see a new wave of this tech optimism, right? Because, you know, the economy has crashed. Governments and industry want to find a new way to grow the economy, or to say that they're going to create jobs and all these sorts of things. And the tech industry in that moment is really poised to take advantage of that, right? The major companies like Apple and Google and Amazon are, and Facebook certainly, are in a position at that moment where they are poised to really take off and to grow to like astounding levels, as we've seen over the past decade, right? And there's also a desire by, I would say, the media to find these figures, to tell these positive stories about the tech industry and the innovation that's happening and how everything is changing for the better. You know, that's the moment when the app economy takes off because the iPhone has just recently launched. It's the moment when there is this boom in startups, in part because of cloud computing has made it easier to start up these like AI startups and things like that. And you also have the gig economy, of course, which is building on the app economy, but is also taking advantage of that pool of labor that has been kind of created by the recession, people who lost their jobs, people who have not been able to find jobs that are equivalent to what they had before and need some extra income. And so go into the gig economy, believe these promises, or don't believe them, but see that that's a way to make money. And there's kind of like a low barrier to entry, right? And so, you know, there's a desire on the political level. Barack Obama and his whole administration is very much part of this effort to promote the tech industry. He has a lot of tech industry people in his administration, really close relationships to them. A lot of those people then go on after the Obama administration to work for these tech companies like Airbnb and Uber and, you know, fight for the very lack of regulations that are producing these big problems, you know, working with Amazon as well, defending it against the whole peeing in bottle scandal last year. You know, all of these people, absolute ghouls who go on to help these tech companies do the absolute most evil things in the world. And so there's this desire to believe that the tech industry is going to save us, so to speak, is going to create these jobs, is going to create this prosperity. And then I would say around 2015, 2016, Brexit, Donald Trump, that era, that optimism and that hope starts to shift, right? I think that there's a realization in that moment that this excitement over the tech industry for the past 5+ years was kind of misguided. And in doing that, we missed a lot of the ways that the tech industry was also doing really negative things, but kind of writing that out of its story through really effective marketing and this desire among a lot of people who shape the narrative to not actually look at those impacts.
Right. So that's the moment we're in now. And like, you know, at this point, like what are the solutions that Silicon Valley is kind of offering to fix problems with transportation? And like, what are the key problems with that vision in terms of both in terms of their social harms, but also just their basic workability in a more practical sense?
Yeah, so there's a ton. And like some of the key ones I talk about in the book are the push for electric vehicles, of course. And that's not just a tech industry thing, but Tesla has been really key to that push and key to the narrative around electric vehicles. So I thought it was worth including that in the book as one of the examples. But then also Uber, of course, the ride hailing services, the idea that you're basically just going to put a taxi app on your smartphone and that's going to make everything better. The autonomous vehicles that were supposed to be promised, that were supposed to be around by now and haven't arrived. The Boring company that Elon Musk has pushed, these tunnels that were supposed to exist under cities to alleviate traffic, and it is now little more than a Disneyland ride in Las Vegas. And then also, of course, the flying cars that were proposed by Uber, which are just a pure joke. And then things like micromobility services, the dockless bikes and scooters, the delivery services for, you know, you order something online and a little robot will take it to your house. So I would say like there are a ton of ideas. They're bad ideas for the most part, right? And I would say the key, like some of the things that connect them, is a lack of consideration for what's actually going to improve transportation, right? What's actually going to make things better for most people. I use this concept that Jarrett Walker, a transport planner, coined called elite projection. And he basically talks about how a lot of these Silicon Valley types have a particular experience of the world, right? Like they come from pretty privileged backgrounds. They have a certain experience of the world. They have a certain idea of how transportation should work, for example, right? People like Elon Musk who think that transit is dangerous and you know, inconvenient, and you might be sitting next to a serial killer if you take the bus or the subway. So he's not someone who's going to promote transit as a means to solve our problems. It has to be through the lens of the car. And many of the other Silicon Valley folks who are interested in transportation have the same approach. And that is in part because they come from this background where, you know, they're used to getting around in the car. They don't want to take transit. They see it as something for poor people. And so the response to fixing transportation has to be through a techno fix, right? Not a political fix that actually addresses more broadly the transportation system that we've built up over these past number of decades or the past century even. And so the problem there is that you're not actually getting to the root causes, right? Okay, so you're putting a new engine technology, so it's going to be battery powered instead of internal combustion engine. Or you're supposedly going to have a computer drive the car instead of a human. Or you're hailing an app on your phone. You're hailing a taxi on your phone rather than, you know, calling a dispatcher or something like that. And in virtually every case, we see that the promises either are not delivered, as I was talking about with Uber, where we've basically seen the opposite of everything that Uber promised, or the technology doesn't arrive, like the self-driving vehicles. And so we just have a decade or so of delaying taking the actions that we need to take because a technology is supposedly coming to save us from these problems. Or we have technologies that, yes, are part of the solution, like an electric vehicle, but they're not the whole solution. They're not the silver bullet, right? And we actually need to do far more than that if we're going to address the problem with climate change. And I'm happy to talk about that more if you want. And so I would say that, you know, when we think about how we're going to solve these problems, the tech industry wants to look at techno fixes, right? New technologies that it can add into the car and that it thinks will solve the problems as a result of that. And what we see time and time again is that they don't actually solve the problem because they don't deal with the politics that actually created the problem in the first place. And that's the fundamental issue there, is that the technology doesn't solve the problem. The politics solves the problem, but they want nothing to do with the political side of that.
And do you think they avoid the political questions primarily? You know, you mentioned this kind of elite projection factor. Do you think that's the key factor, or are there other reasons why they are so keen to avoid these more difficult questions?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of these folks have kind of a libertarian worldview anyway. And that certainly emerges from an ideology that has been present in the Valley, in the tech industry for a while, where there's this faith in technology and in the market and in the ability of technology to like empower the individual, that downplays the role of the government, even though like the state, the US government has been really key to building the tech industry in the United States. But then I would say even beyond that, like it's something that you can see with, say, Elon Musk, for example. There's also a desire to not have the government get in the way of, you know, whatever they want to unleash on the world, whether it's, you know, a taxi app that tries to destroy the taxi regulations that exist so that they can do whatever they want with the workers, or someone like Elon Musk, for example, who, you know, says he wants to go to Mars and take us to Mars and all these sorts of things, but gets angry every single time the government steps in and says, you know, there might be some environmental regulations that you're breaking here in Texas where you're trying to launch us off to Mars or whatnot. And so every single time that there's an attempt at enforcement or some kind of authority from the government, you know, he gets annoyed at that because he doesn't want anyone to stand in the way of achieving his kind of vision. So I think that there are like personal factors to it that they just feel themselves to be beyond like the control of the government. But then there are also like kind of more ideological and commercial reasons why they try to ignore the political side of it, because they don't want the government to step in or have any kind of role here.
And like your book's focus is primarily on the US, since of course that's where the kind of the supremacy of the car really is at its, you know, zenith, I guess. And I should say, like, I was in the UK recently visiting family, and like, you know, I don't want to applaud the UK rail infrastructure because, like, it's, you know, from decades of privatization, the rail fares are sky high, its service is getting poorer. But I can take a train from Heathrow Airport to my parents' front door. And they live in a rural town. But now in Canada, I live in a, you know, small coastal town in British Columbia. I can barely take a bus to get to the grocery store. Like, I have to own a car here. And that's actually the only reason I have a driver's license, is because I moved here, essentially. Even countries like the UK, which have bad rail service, have at least the infrastructure in place. So I'm guessing, and maybe the UK is not the best example, but like, are there other jurisdictions where they're doing a better job of trying to fix transportation issues with public solutions?
Yeah, absolutely. And like, maybe not every country like has done everything right, right? But there's certainly other countries that we can look to for examples of how things can be better, right? How you can make investments to make things better. Like, you know, obviously one of the standout examples from the past few years is the effort that Paris has put into expanding cycling. You know, the kind of explosion in the number of people who are riding bikes in the city since the pandemic is huge, because, you know, the government had been working on these things for a while, but then the pandemic arrived and they just accelerated their plans, closed a bunch of streets, expanded cycling lanes, and like the number of people riding bikes has exploded, right? Which is huge. You know, naturally, I would be remiss not to mention China's investments in high-speed rail, which I think are fantastic. And like, sure, we might not have the population density to support high-speed rail all over Canada, But I think we should definitely have high speed rail in like southern Ontario through the Quebec and, you know, possibly other pockets of the country, right? Like it just seems absolutely natural. One of the problems is that, you know, there has been in Canada and the United States as well, this focus on the car for such a long time, right? And our policy has been completely oriented around that, particularly since the end of the Second World War. And, you know, that was sold to us for a long time through marketing and through, you know, statements by these companies, statements by the government, that this was something that should be desirable, that this was the future, that this was what we needed to achieve, because it was something that served a lot of commercial interests who were going to profit from it and benefit from it, right? But now I think decades on from that experiment, I think we can see that building societies around the automobile is actually incredibly expensive when you look at the tax money that's essential to like upkeep all those roads, all that infrastructure when you have all these low density communities. But then on top of that, you know, the deaths that come of it, the high personal cost of everyone having to own their own personal automobile. The CAA estimates it's something between like $8,000 and $12,000 a year that goes into maintaining a car and keeping a car and paying everything associated with it. So that's a huge cost for a lot of people, particularly lower income people, right? And so like, I think we're at a moment when we can make a decision around what the future of transportation is going to look like in the country. And we're kind of being given two paths, right? One where we continue down the road of automobility through adopting the electric car and just switching over all of our internal combustion engines to that and just kind of accepting that everything else stays the same, which doesn't seem very ambitious and certainly doesn't address the scale of the problems that we face from you know, the entrenchment and the dependence on the automobile that has come of that. It doesn't even fully address the climate contribution of the automobile. Or we can think much more fundamentally about the communities that we live in, you know, expand transit infrastructure, expand cycling, make the rail infrastructure better, ensure that we're building communities that are more walkable and where, you know, the services that people rely on are close to where they live. And that requires more action by the government, like a really concerted plan by the government in order to have that happen. And the reason why we're trending on this electric vehicle path is that it works for a lot of commercial interests, but the government also doesn't want to like really have to do very much. And so in order to get like the better future that we want, the one that serves us best, you know, it's going to take pushing the government to really do it, to really step up to the plate.
Yeah, we should come back to this question of the climate issue as well. Like, you know, what are the stakes here? What is the difference in terms of addressing, you know, greenhouse gas emissions car versus, you know, more public oriented solutions?
Yeah, it's a significant difference, right? Because like, even if you just think about it, there's a lot more resources and a lot more energy that goes into every single person having to drive and own their own personal vehicle than if, you know, there were more collective solutions for how we get around. And so what we're seeing right now, as I was saying, is there's this big push for electric vehicles because Canada already has automotive manufacturing as, you know, one of the industries that we have here. And it's an industry that is particularly valued, politically popular, things like that. And also Canada is the country where 75% of global mining companies are headquartered. And so, you know, by expanding electric vehicles and by having a plan where electric vehicles will replace virtually every other vehicle on the road, that's going to require a lot more mining. That is going to be very beneficial for a lot of these companies, and they can use it in order to greenwash their operations, which we know are incredibly environmentally harmful, but also have effects on the communities and the workers who work in those mines as well. The International Energy Agency estimates that, you know, for this transition, if we go toward a transition that is very reliant on electric vehicles, we're going to see increases in demand for lithium of up to 4,200%, nickel and cobalt over 2,000%. Like, this is a lot more extraction that's going to have to happen. And, you know, based on the timescales that we're being given right now, it's going to have to happen in a very short period of time if we're going to meet the kind of targets that we have for electric vehicle adoption. And so to think that that's going to be done in a very like human rights oriented, environmentally conscious way, I just don't think that's, you know, accurate. I don't think you can believe that. And so that's why we face this choice, right? Do we focus on the electric vehicles and using that as the key to the transportation system when it's going to require so many more resources and so much more energy than an alternative path where we do focus more on public transportation and actually getting more people, or as many people as possible, out of their cars, able to use a bike, able to take the bus, able to take the subway. And that doesn't mean that there will be no cars and no automobiles in Canadian society, right? Like, as we've been talking about, it's taken decades to get us to this place where so many people are reliant on it, even especially in rural areas. I think people are still going to be reliant on cars for some time in the future. But that doesn't mean that we can't start making these changes today that are going to be really necessary, and that a few years down the line, 10 years down the line, we can really start to see some of the benefits of those. But that action needs to start being taken now so that we can realize those benefits in the years to come.
Well, I think that's a great series of solutions and ideas that we can end on there. Where can people find your book and your work more generally?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on the show. They can find me on Twitter. I'm at Paris Marks. They can find the podcast anywhere you listen to the podcast. It should be there. Tech Won't Save Us. And the book, you can buy it, Road to Nowhere, from Verso Books, which is the publisher. But you can also find it at like any major bookseller, whether it's Amazon, which is not one I would personally support, but you can also find it at Chapters or anywhere else too.
That's terrific. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Paris.
Thanks so much.
North Untapped is a podcast brought to you by The Maple. To support our work, please go to readthemaple.com and press subscribe. Thank you for your support.